Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, leading the search for Christian unity, Cardinal Walter Kasper reflects on efforts to heal divisions between different Christian denominations. Plus, climate change and the church, why Christians should be leading the way in the struggle against global warming. Catholic Church's relations with other Christian denominations were under the spotlight earlier this month as the Vatican's top spokesman on ecumenical dialogue, Cardinal Walter Kasper, marked his 75th birthday, the age at which every Catholic bishop must offer his resignation to the Pope. The Cardinal, who has headed the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity since 2001, marked the occasion in traditional German style with the publication of two books, a re-edition of his own work entitled The God of Jesus Christ, and a tribute volume written by two of the Cardinal's former students, with an introduction by his compatriot and fellow theologian, Pope Benedict XVI.
That's the 75th birthday is a very significant birthday because every bishop and cardinal has to offer to the Pope the dimission of his office, and I did it already, but I guess that I have to stay still some time here.
Speaking to journalists for the launch of these two publications, Cardinal Walter Kasper reminisced about his life as a priest and his work to heal the divisions between the different Christian churches.
It's a fascinating task I have here, to work for the unity of the church, have the dialogue with the Jewish people. I cannot imagine a more fascinating work. And so forth, this person is important for me. I have to look back, and have to look back very gratefully, because 75 years without very strong illness, without incidents and so on, it's very important, and to be grateful for this, or to be grateful to people who have accompanied me on my way of life. And, well, now I hope that I can do still something in theology, especially it's my enthusiasm to do theology and to contribute to others what I have thought or what I have experienced, because in this book there's now also a lot of experience all over the world. And I feel always as a pastor, when I go travel around the world, not as a diplomat, I never have studied diplomacy, but well, some psychology is needed, but every pastor must have also some psychology. But I want a little bit to share what I have experienced, what I have learned, what I have thought to other people, and perhaps it can be helpful for their own way of life.
In these books, you go back, or in this particular work, you go back to the roots of your faith, don't you? Your understanding of God.
Oh, yes. Belief in God is a fundament of every religion, also of Christian religion. And I think it's very timely to speak on God and not on superficial, marginal questions. But who is God? And many people are seeking around the way for God, and often they did not get an answer. They want to pray, cannot pray, and all their pilgrims on the way to God. And I think it's a task of theology to speak about God, also how God and suffering can be combined. This is a problem of theodicy is very important, and I try to speak about the God of Jesus Christ, not as a vague God and a God who is everywhere, very far away from our life now, who is in the midst of us, who is our Father, and the Father of Jesus Christ and his Son. And so I think we must come back to the basic themes of our faith, and it's a question of God. We are also questioned because there is a new wave of atheism now, of a very aggressive atheism, a missionary atheism, and we have to respond. Then the non-Christian religions are in our midst, especially Islam. Well, we have some in common with them, but there are also significant differences. And I think there's a lot to do for theologians today.
What do you see as the most significant threat? Do you see it as the other religions, or do you see it as the secular world, this aggressive secularism, as you call it?
I think it's two challenges we face. They are very different. The challenge by the other religions, which are present here also now in Europe, and the presence of secularism, who do not think that God is no longer important, you can forget about him, he's only private for you, for your private life, but now God returned also to the public scene, so Islam put a new the question of the relation between God and power, violence, and I think it's a very important question to show. Well, the God of Christianity is not only the loving God in a very superficial way, but he's not a God of violence. And this is a very important point, and many people are bothered about this problem.
You say you have a fascinating job here, and yes, there have been some very important developments since you took over as head of the Council for Christian Unity. What to you perhaps is the single most significant piece of progress that has happened while you've been here?
Well, there are several points. I think there's a revival of the dialogue with the Orthodox and the Oriental Orthodox churches. When I started, it was a very bad situation, and now we are in a good way. And the second one, we have a change in the ecumenical scene with the Protestant, a very big change. We are no longer on the point where we were after the Council. There is an enlargement of the dialogue. Many free churches want today dialogue. Also, there are Salvation Army and the Mennonites and all these free churches. An enlargement on the other hand in the mainline church. There are inner developments where we have today also differences in ethical questions we never had before, about abortion, euthanasia, and all these kind of problems, and also some liberal tendencies in Protestant churches. And you see, it's best when you think on Anglicanism, they are in a very difficult situation. We try to help them to find again their identity and unity, but this is a new situation which makes the dialogue much more difficult. Nevertheless, we are decided to go on. It's an irreversible decision of the Second Vatican Council.
Finally, Patriarch Bartholomew is coming here this week for the anniversary of the Oriental Institute. Yes. How significant is this visit and his meeting with Pope Benedict?
Well, we have a very relaxed relation now with the Ecumenical Patriarchate and the Ecumenical Patriarch in person. And it's very normal when he comes here for this anniversary, he meets the Pope invites him to have meal together, and grew up a lot of friendship, of mutual trust, and this is very important, and I'm very happy about this development, especially with the Ecumenical Patriarchate, and this has reflections, has consequences, I think, for all other Orthodox churches.
Perhaps these informal meetings are almost as important as the documents and the formal declarations.
We need both. We need the documents, we need the formal meetings, but they can be successful only if there is mutual trust, informal relation, if there is some friendship, and that's the basis. And then on this basis, theological dialogue is possible.
And my thanks there to Cardinal Walter Kasper, head of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. The consequences of climate change are being felt not only in the environment, but also in the entire socio-economic system, with the poorest and most vulnerable people and nations at greatest risk. Those were the words of the Vatican's representative to the UN in New York, Archbishop Celestino Migliore, in May 2007 to the Commission on Sustainable Development, a warning which has been reiterated by other religious and political leaders repeatedly over the past year. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon recently urged all countries to join forces with the private sector, civil groups and individuals around the world to take action and sustain what he called the unprecedented momentum to fight global warming. At the start of a two-day UN General Assembly debate on a proposed new global warming treaty, the UN leader said 2008 must be the year of concerted action to draw up a new blueprint to cut global warming gases. At the last UN Climate Change Conference in Bali last December, delegates from nearly 190 nations agreed to adopt such a blueprint before the end of next year. But according to some experts, more decisive action is urgently needed, and the churches should be showing the way.
Because the destiny of our world, either we live together and flourish, or in actual fact we're going to damage all the ecosystems. And if ecosystems are damaged, they're damaged for us too. So you can't have life to the full on a sick and damaged planet.
Former missionary father Sean McDonough is a well-known author and expert on climate change. He campaigns tirelessly to encourage church leaders to put greater emphasis on these ecological concerns. I sat down with him to discuss these latest developments and find out why he believes that climate change has finally made it to the top of the political agenda.
Well, I suppose there's a confluence of factors. In 1986, the British government commissioned a report from an economist, Sir Nicholas Stern, and that focused, yes, that this climate change could be the worst economic catastrophe to hit the world in the next number of years or two decades. So very often, very much, economics is at the heart of the modern world. Not something I particularly like, but that's where it's at. Then last year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, what's called the IPCC, they published their fourth assessment report, which 90% sure, which means 100% sure, that actually climate change is already happening, that it could be very significant, and that the window of opportunity to do something about it, in other words, to keep the level, the increase in temperature below 2 degrees Celsius, is 15 to 20 years. So there's an extraordinary urgency about the issue right now.
This is suddenly what's making an impact on people, isn't it? The fact that we were talking a few hundred years away, now we're talking just one generation away, if that.
That's right, from the scientific and from the political perspective. I wouldn't be sure, though, that it has transferred into the economic perspective. And why do I say that? You can read the newspapers and you'll see something, for example, on news items and on reflections. But if you go over to the financial pages, you will still see that the economics that's been pushed is an economics that actually externalizes things to people and to the environment. The neoliberal economic agenda is still very much in place. And as long as that is in place, then, of course, this thing is going to get much worse, because the only way out to develop at the moment is by becoming dependent on fossil fuel. And the more countries, like, for example, China and India, that are becoming more and more dependent on fossil fuel, are going to make this situation worse. So we kind of really now are in a difficult position. We're talking about it, we're convinced about it politically, but economically we're going in the wrong direction. And I think that's a huge change. I saw that very much in Bali. There was no effort to challenge the economic paradigm. The underlying assumption was we can solve climate change within the reality of a market forces economy. The reality for me personally is we can't.
Bali was very disappointing, wasn't it, the conference that went
very,
on
very there. Disappointing, for a number of reasons. I mean, if you take seriously the IPCC report, then you should be seeing a drop by 20 to 40% in greenhouse gas emissions for what's called the OECD countries by the year 2020. That's absolutely necessary, and yet no one took that up. The European Union were pushing it, but the United States delegation and Canada almost vetoed up till the last night. And then, of course, the newly developed countries, they're not willing to jump, because they basically say, historically, your affluence is based on a carbon economy for the last 150 years. Why should we jump now unless you jump before us? So we have 2 years now before Copenhagen. And that was the great sadness about Bali, that we weren't beginning to put in place a new regime which would go much beyond Kyoto. And people are not aware really how much that will be. Kyoto was only five. We were to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 5 to 7% below 1990 levels. Now what we're looking is 20 to 40%. In other words, you're almost halving your carbon in your economy. So unless you're actually producing energy in a way that's not carbon dependent, you're going one way with your talk, but another way with your action. And that, to me, is a real challenge at the moment.
As you say, European governments are pledging to try and take this very seriously, to meet these targets. Mm. Do you think it's a realistic proposal or not?
Well, there were difficulties about it. For example, one dimension of it was we were to include, for example, 20% increase in biofuels. Now, you have to think seriously, think through those sort of policy decisions. Where would these biofuels be coming from? Many of them would be coming from Southeast Asia, where people are burning forests, tropical forests, destroying all the biodiversity, putting all this carbon into the air, and then monocropping palm oil plantations. If you did an energy audit on it, you'd probably find that actually there's a net gain in CO2 emissions. So the European Union and countries within the European Union have to think seriously about the implications of this. The other side of it, of course, is from the agenda for the Global Millennium Goals. The problem at the moment is if your lands are being used for food or to buy energy crops. So you could have a appalling situation that the lands of the third world are going to be used to grow energy crops for the first world. So I think that's an ethical issue that's going to arise. Should you be burning food for energy at this time? And I don't think you should.
Alongside this, there are still those who refuse to admit that this really is a very serious problem, that perhaps there's nothing wrong with global warming. What's your answer to them now?
Well, my answer at the scientific level, there are still a number of people who think smoking is good for you. You know, if you have a problem and you're bringing a cigarette to your mouth every couple of seconds, it's good for your nerves. It settles you down. You know, there is no evidence in the world. All the evidence is pointing in the other direction. So I do say to people, would you bring on someone from Philip Morris to give a kind of a balanced view of tobacco? And the answer is you wouldn't. And I think that the same should be true of climate change. And any situation I'm involved with, I almost refuse to actually talk about the other side. And of course, all you have to do is look at the ExxonMobil, look at their website. They are still paying groups in the United States to come out with documents that are not peer-reviewed. And these documents, until very recently, were seized by the Bush administration to bolster their position that they were sceptic about climate change. Now they're supposed to have been converted, but in reality they have not been, because you saw what happened the week after Bali. California wanted to bring in legislation that emissions from cars would increase. For example, the mileage of cars would increase to 35 miles to the gallon, and the EPA, the group that should be protecting the environment and protecting the quality of air, and actually got the nod from a very conservative Supreme Court to do it earlier last year, are now willing to take these people to court. I mean, it makes no sense whatever, because almost every other jurisdiction, even in China, Chinese motor cars at the moment, they at the moment do at least 35 miles to the gallon. So, I mean, it's just obviously the Bush administration protecting its own very, very narrow base, which is petrochemical industry and possibly the auto industry in the United States.
We're looking ahead to elections, of course, in the US. Are you hopeful that these issues will be high on the agenda of the next government?
Well, I'm not really, because I just saw, and I reported there in one of my articles, that until about a month ago, the sort of talking heads had asked people something like 3,000 questions. And out of those 3,000 questions, only 24 related to climate change. Now, having said that, on the Democratic side, either Senator Obama or Senator Clinton, both of them are coming out with something beyond the Kyoto Protocol. On the Republican side, the only man who has come out with anything, actually, he's co-sponsored the bill in Congress there 2 years ago, is Senator John McCain. So one would hope, yes. The other thing, of course, and it was very clear in Bali, there were a lot of groups from the United States, particularly from states. There are 7 states in the West, there are 12 states in the East, that are actually voluntarily taking up the kind of a commitments that's in the Kyoto Agreement, for very good reasons, because the California realises, the governor there realises that if global warming takes place, then the snows on the Sierra Madres will not be able to supply Southern California with water. And if you don't have water coming from another source in Southern California, you won't be able to live there. So it's enlightened self-interest more than an altruistic approach from the said governor.
You rightly say this is a moral issue, it's an ethical issue, and yet the church has been slow, in your view, hasn't it,
yes,
to take it up?
Well, you see, The church is for the life of the world. That's John's gospel. I've come for, or John 10:10, I've come that they may have life and have it to the full. Now, if it's the most serious issue facing human beings, and then also facing habitats in which human beings have lived since the last ice age, because these habitats will no longer be available for humankind. For example, the habitat of the Delta area in Bangladesh. 35 million people live there, and if there's a rise of just over a metre in sea levels around that place, that will be uninhabitable into the long-term future. So, yeah, and it will cause deaths for literally tens, if not hundreds of millions of people. So, obviously, it is a serious moral issue. And obviously, if it's a serious moral issue, it's a serious theological issue, because we're talking, I mean, at one level we talk about the world, but the world, in the view of religious people, is God's creation. So I do think we need to do, from the church's perspective, to develop a really robust theology of creation. And basically saying the stewardship model, that's not at all sufficient. Because first of all, it's too homocentric. The reality is we say we steward for the world. In actual fact, the world looks after us. You and I are breathing oxygen from which is created by our beautiful world. You and I have eaten our breakfast. So we are totally dependent on God's creation to live. And I think we're going to have to begin. Yes, there is a dimension for caring for creation and stewardship, but we need to go way beyond that. And one of the ways we need to go beyond that is to give value to other elements of God's creation. I mean, one of the issues of climate change is it will probably wipe out a million species. So that ties in with the other major ecological issue of our time, which is the destruction of biodiversity. Now, I'd like to think that we can begin to see in our theology that these, every one of these creatures, every species has real value in the eyes of God. And therefore we develop that biocentric approach. And we have it in the Hebrew scriptures, the whole saga of Noah, not just taking his family, but taking two of each creatures. So there, right from the beginning, is a concern for God's creation. Then, of course, we have to have a real concern for the fact that the poor who have done little to cause it are the ones who are actually going to suffer most. And that's an extraordinary tragedy from the point, like Africa, will probably, grain production could be down in Africa by 50% because it depends mainly on rain-fed agriculture there. So there are a whole series. I mean, I would talk about solidarity, that the late Pope John Paul talked about solidarity with the poor, but not just with the poor, with other creatures as well, because the destiny of our world, either we live together and flourish, or in actual fact we're going to damage all the ecosystems. And if ecosystems are damaged, they're damaged for us too. So you can't have life to the full on a sick and damaged planet. Now, the church has wonderful resources in its own tradition. The whole notion of common good, the whole notion of natural law, the destroying processes of nature. Now, we need to develop these to underpin a very robust theology and also ethical framework. Because ultimately, unless people see it from an ethical perspective, then I don't think they're going to change their attitudes and change their behaviour. And as we're talking this in Lent, here is really an occasion where people can begin to say, I've got to change my lifestyle, not because, well, I'm going to do something for Lent, but if I continue to live this way, then many people on earth will not be able to live like this. And also we're going to make life on earth more difficult for every succeeding generation of humankind and other creatures. So the ethical framework and the ascetic framework are actually built into each other. And Christian and the Catholic tradition has wonderful things to say about that. But we have been so slow. We've put it in a kind of the last paragraph of documents rather than right at the middle of it.
And yet we've noticed increasingly the number of churches that are taking up this issue, particularly during Lent. For example, your own agency, Trochra, yeah, back in Ireland, CAFOD. I've noticed, yeah, the Tear Fund have also been calling for this, yeah, kind of action, really focusing at this time of year on the ways in which we can change our lives, but not just for Lent, as you say.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing about these development agencies, they are now beginning to see that climate change is having a massive impact on the kinds of people that they have been dealing with for the last 40 years. Until now, they felt that development issues, we will stick with those and not sort of confuse ourselves by bringing in this ecological or climate. But now they're saying, for example, I went through the Philippines there before Christmas for 4 weeks before the Bali conference. Every place I went, farmers were saying, the southern monsoons seem to be gone. So that means a whole harvest of food for people who are subsistence farmers. So it means a lot of people are going to be hungry. And, I mean, the big thing for Southeast Asia is, and will be the fastest thing, is the melting of the ice on the Himalayas, because that supplies the water for the great six great rivers of Asia, the Indus in Pakistan, the Ganges, Brahmaputra in India and Bangladesh, the Mekong, Southeast Asia, and then the two Chinese rivers, the Guangzhou, we call it the Yangtze, and that's 3 billion people. And the scientists are projecting by 2030, 80% of the mass of the ice and glaciers on the Himalayas might be gone. That would be just frightening. Where would all these people go? Who would take in? You'd have an enormous amount of climate refugees. So these are very serious issues, and areas like, or groups like Caritas, like CAFOD and TROCRA are beginning to see this and beginning to move it into centre stage, not just on the sort of the wings of the stage where it has been until now. Now they're saying the environmental issue and the development issue are two sides of the same coin.
You're talking about developing this theology of ecology. You'd like to see it taught in seminaries, for example, wouldn't you? What other practical suggestions do you have to really make this issue a very urgent one for the church?
Oh, I would like to see it taught everywhere where Christian doctrine is taught. Because one of the difficulties with us in the whole area of environment, we haven't got a coherent discourse about it. At one level, we say, we're earthlings. And next breath, we say, well, we're for another world. Now, we have got to get our discourse that we're not making these kind of talking out of both sides of our mouths. As far as I'm concerned, humankind are earthlings. We can't live anywhere else. We need air, we need water, we need food. Now, that doesn't mean in our belief that we have not a very robust belief in the world that is to come. But the world, if you take Matthew 25, the world that is to come is dependent on how we live in this world. He's not giving us any great insight. He's saying, basically saying to you, the God you serve and the God who has loved you in this world will also be there to serve in the future world. We know the model is the resurrection of Christ, but that's what all we know. We don't know the physics of it. We don't know the biology of it. But we do know the challenge of being Christian is in the Our Father, your kingdom come, thy will be done on earth. Now, done on earth means that we live in a world, a mutually enhancing relationship between humankind and the rest of creation for the well-being of everyone, but also for the well-being of the human poor.
What is your message to church leaders right now, today? What would you most like to see them doing?
I'd love to see them taking this very seriously. And one way of doing that would be, for example, in the Australian church and the Philippine church at the moment, they have decided to take what's called the time of creation every year from the first Sunday of September to the Feast of St. Francis. Each year, it's either 4 or 5 Sundays. So you would take a theme each year, like for each Sunday, like, for example, climate change, like the destruction of species, like, for example, the pollution of the oceans, like, for example, fresh water, and that you would knit into it prayers, ceremonies, readings from the scripture, that it would help to connect people's agenda of working for a safe environment, working for a fruitful environment, and also their service of God and their understanding that these two things are the same. And we as a group, as a Christian people who believe in incarnation, that the divine became part of creation, shouldn't have any major problem with that. I mean, that should become second nature to us. If God became part of the fabric of creation, why shouldn't we be actually thrilled to help people to see that their work for the poor, their work for protecting creation are essentially at the heart of their Christian faith. And I believe we've got to move from the periphery right into the ecology at the heart of Christian faith.
And my thanks there to Columban Father Sean McDonough, author and expert on climate change. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.